This week on the According to Sources podcast, just when it seemed like the Athena health process was essentially dead on arrival, Bloomberg is saying, now it's not. A U.S. senator appears to have been duped by a fake Department of Defense memo. And I answered the seven most interesting and thought-provoking email and tweets sent in this week. I'm Mike Samuels, founder and portfolio manager of Broome Street Capital, and this is According to Sources for the week of October 14th, 2018.
It's crossing the tape right now. Let me explain what's happening here.
Some breaking news to share with you this morning, M&A related.
There's good activism.
I think eBay is in that situation. They got a jewel in PayPal.
There's bad activism.
Unfortunately, JCPenney was a dying company.
Examples of activism gone awry.
It was not a surprise to me that that deal fell through.
This is such a game changer.
Hello and welcome to According to Sources, a podcast that speculates on mergers and acquisitions, activism and events, and the sources that both cover and surround them. And speaking of sources, I think that's a great place to start this week, because in the 12 years that I've been following deals, I don't think I can ever remember a situation where the reporting has been so divided as I've seen now with Athena Health. And the ticker again, if you don't need a reminder, is ATHN. On one hand, you've had both Deal Reporter and the New York Post, who repeatedly have authored stories with details about bidders dropping out, a company called Enthrive being the strategic bidder involved, and a process that, as of only a few days ago, had bids no greater than $135 a share. And then on the other side, you've had CNBC's David Faber, and most recently, Bloomberg's Ed Hammond, saying the process is, quote, robust, with Bloomberg recently saying that there were multiple bidders, in fact, five bidders, all of which were 135 and above. Now, to me, what essentially confused matters even more is that Bloomberg broke the latest Athena news on TV, and Ed Hammond's Bloomberg TV story on Athena had some major discrepancies than the written article that followed on the Bloomberg terminal roughly 30 minutes later. And the first example can be heard in this clip from Friday.
They have a much more robust process than it implies. I'm told there are at least five bidders, some strategic, some financial, still in the process.
Five bidders, some financial, some strategic. Now, in the Bloomberg article, however, that again came about 30 minutes after this appearance, there was no mention of a strategic. In fact, he mentions four private equity companies and then Elliott Advisors, making five. So unless Ed is referring to a company such as perhaps Waystar, which is a healthcare company within Bain Capital, one of the PE companies he mentioned, then the two stories appear to not line up. Next, Bloomberg anchor Vonnie Quinn asked Ed to elaborate on the price expectations for the Athena asset, and this is what he said.
I think there have been some funny numbers being thrown out. 160 was thrown out, 1.160 a share. I'm told that's probably too high. The company doesn't expect to sell for that. But I think above this 135 number is what I've been guided towards. So I think you could see somewhere around 140, even potentially up to 150 at the very high end.
140 to 150 a share for the price tag. And again, there is no mention of those of either of those figures in the written article, which has to beg the question, are the sources telling Ed these figures, or is he essentially estimating what the figures could be based on the guidance that the sources were giving him, that it was over 135 a share? The third point I'd like to make is that the TV segment implied that Elliott was looking to roll their equity into whoever is the winning bidder, while the article reiterates that, but also says that they are still, quote, weighing a bid. Here's what the big questions to me are right now. Number one, why did an entirely new auction process seem to start after the September 27th bid deadline passed? Or was that never the correct date at all? Why wasn't the highest bid simply awarded that asset if they were the highest bid at the end of the date? Second question, since David Faber implied that a strategic entered the auction in late September, and Ed Hammond is saying that that strategic isn't Enthrive, then who is it? Is it Epic Systems, the name that Elliott perhaps implied or was hoping would be there all along? Is it Cerner, C-E-R-N? At the end of the day, we really don't know. And the question is, do I want to gamble on the New York Post Or do I want to bet on Ed Hammond, who was kind enough to be on the show, and I consider him to be one of the best M&A journalists out there? And David Faber, also one of the best, has yet to back down or retract his previous story. But until I can get some answers on these questions, Athena remains very difficult to be long in any kind of size. Speaking of investing, this is probably a good time to read the weekly disclaimer that, again, this is not investing advice. Everything spoken during this podcast is simply the opinion of myself and Broome Street Capital, which is, again, 100% funded with my own capital. If you decide to join me in a position based on the discussions in this podcast, that means we are in the same trade, but I cannot be held liable for any losses that may occur. Moving on to the most frustrating story of the week, I would say, and that occurred when Republican Senator from the state of Kentucky, Rand Paul, decided for some reason to weigh in on the Broadcom deal to buy CA Inc., formerly known as Computer Associates.
Computer Associates have a lot of their software and hardware and everything else scattered throughout our electrical grid in our nuclear power plants. I think it goes right to the heart and core of, you know, is this a national security risk? We are going to advocate in a written form to all the members of the CFIUS committee that this should be reviewed.
Those comments from Senator Paul sent shares of CA down nearly 5% on Wednesday. Although Rand Paul denies that his actions were prompted by a now-known fake Department of Defense memo, I do find that hard to believe, and it's probably more likely he's simply covering his tracks. And while there's no proof that a short seller initiated the memo, the SEC, as well as the Justice Department, are investigating. The question is, can CFIUS block a deal between two companies based in the United States? It would be quite a stretch. And, you know, remember, the reason that the Broadcom-Qualcomm deal was blocked was sort of on a technicality. Broadcom wasn't yet a U.S.-domiciled business. They are now. But the important distinction that I think needs to be recognized between the Qualcomm situation and the CA situation is that Qualcomm was lobbying very hard not to be bought out. And CA is a willing participant in their buyout. So the question is, can this deal be blocked at all? So listen, the president, especially this president, always has at his disposal the what's called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which authorizes him to essentially block any deal on his own accord, as he did with Qualcomm Broadcom. But I find that to be extremely unlikely. And I did buy some shares last week. It's been a press release that a November 5th close is expected, and my plan is to tender that small position picked up last week. Now, earlier last week, I tweeted out to send me any questions that might be on your mind. Is there something that you want discussed on the podcast? To send and tweet those out, and I'd like to spend the remainder of today's podcast answering 7 of those tweets and emails. And again, you can always follow me on Twitter. I do tweet my ideas and thoughts in real time. The handle is @AccordToSources. That's ACCORDTO Sources. And again, you can also email me. That is Michael@AccordingToSourcesPodcast.com. The first question is entitled Remaining Milestones for a Deal. Yes, how do you source yours? I always feel like some ink deal has some unexpected or expected news break, but the spread doesn't collapse as much because more hurdles remain. SEC filings do not appear to consistently list approvals needed. And, you know, he continued on the email. He used the example of CVS and Aetna, which got a Department of Justice approval and now has a few remaining states. And this is a great question. And my answer to this is, I guess, going to be a bit complicated, but I'll try my best. Each deal, in my opinion, is different. And sometimes a shareholder vote will matter the most, like with Shire and Takeda. And sometimes China will matter, like it does with Disney and Fox right now. Sometimes CFIUS is a hurdle, like we saw with, obviously, NXPI. And now we're going to see it a little bit with CA in a bizarre way. Antitrust or the Department of Justice matters in a case like T-Mobile and Sprint. There are firms such as United First Partners, Churchill, Beacon, Wallachbeth, that specialize specifically in mergers and event research, and they have fairly good knowledge of the events and hurdles for each specific situation. This is what they do. And if you remember, a few months ago, I actually had Jason Varano of the Nomura Events Desk on, and I find their team also has a very good grasp of these headlines. But to be totally and completely honest, one of the main motivations for me to start this podcast about 6 months ago was to answer questions just like that for myself. You know, while these merger and event desks are a good asset to have and have access to, I was finding them to be wrong often. I mean, I can't tell you how many event desks told me, for example, that the Shire-Takeda spread would be 5 to 7% on a deal announcement. And we're still not there yet, and we're roughly 4 months since the announcement. You know, I express my opinions on this podcast with the goal being to start a conversation around the deal situation. And that's exactly what's been occurring. I mean, this week alone, I was involved in a lengthy Twitter thread on the future of Axalta and the ticker there at AXTA. Other occasions, I might just be debating merger spreads with someone. This is why I've been doing this podcast. Question number two, are you still long Barnes & Noble? Yes. Remember, the stock actually went ex-dividend 15 cents a share on Friday. I actually have increased my position since last week's podcast, and it now currently surpasses AEL as my biggest holding. I really feel like this time is different for BKS. You know, there's a certain number of stocks that have pump faked over the years a few times before they were actually taken over. I can think of DreamWorks or Time Inc. I've often discussed how I think Mattel actually could wind up being in this category as well. It sometimes just takes a few tries for certain companies. And I think for Barnes & Noble, this time truly is different. And for the first time, the reason that I think it's different, for the first time, an independent committee, not Leonard Riggio, is handling the process. And I think it could be fairly quick. I had Gabelli analyst John Tinker as a guest on last week's show. He thinks it could be perhaps a month or two. Question three, at George Cepeda asked my thoughts on Tribune Publishing, which is now ticker TPCO. I talk about a company that has pump faked a few times in the past. This thing has fooled me too many times to ever get back involved here. The biggest losses of my career have been in two stocks. The first one was when the Axalta deal fell apart last year. That was AXTA. They were supposed to be bought out by Nippon, a Japanese company. And the other one was betting on a deal between Gannett and Tribune, which at the time was called Tronc. T-R-N-C was the ticker then. And I learned a valuable lesson from that experience, and that was, remember, Michael Farrow, who was the former CEO of TRNC, was adamantly against selling his company. And in the end, the deal collapsed due to a lack of financing on Gannett's end. But the lesson learned was avoid speculating on deals when management is adamantly against selling. And it's a reason that I never had a position in Qualcomm, for example. Now, Michael Farrow is no longer running the show at Tribune after getting ousted due to some Me Too movement-worthy allegations. But the situation is still bizarre. Same cast of characters are still there. Patrick Stoon is involved. Apollo's there. Now you have McClatchy. The New York Post is saying that McClatchy, which is a company with $60 million in equity value and $800 million in debt, they are now the prospective buyer, and they supposedly have Apollo's backing. But again, I've been burned in this before badly. A lot of the same people are there, and the situation is just too complex for me right now. Question number four, any views on the timeline for AEL? AEL, this is a company I've spoken about several times on the podcast. It's until BKS came along was my largest position. Bloomberg put out a story on the 12th of October describing the current feud that's going on between Apollo and former employee Imran Siddiqui, who left the firm to start his own venture called Caldera. Now, the article describes just how crucial the relationship between Athene, ticker ATH, and Apollo is. And again, I tweeted this article out. You can find it on my Twitter handle again. Apollo derives 25% of its management fees from Athene, even though they only own 10% of the company's equity. There was actually a good quote from the article, and it said, "People close to Apollo joke that it's no longer a private equity firm with an insurance unit. Rather, it's an insurance company with a private equity division." Now, Caldera is attempting to create its own relationship by purchasing AEL. And the reason that I've been long is because Caldera isn't valuing AEL the business. They're valuing AEL the platform. And it's a platform to which they hope to grow an enormous business, much like Apollo has done with Athene. Now, I'm long AEL still, but I have no better sense of timing than I did in July, unfortunately, but I do think the upside could be into the low 40s. Question number five, little off topic, but if you had to pick three companies that you had to hold for 10 years, what would they be and why? So as I said, this podcast focuses on M&A, activism, special situations. So for me, picking a stock that I have to hold long term is most definitely out of my comfort zone and out of my area of that I think I have some expertise in. If I was going to do this, and I recently was asked to do this for a newborn, I'd want to pick a business that was essentially part of some sort of oligopoly, right? That's what Warren Buffett seems to do, something that I know will be there in 10 years and has enormous pricing pressure. So I did give this a bit of thought, and the three companies that I decided to talk about today were Comcast, because they control the pipes in this country as much as anyone else does. I'd pick Wells Fargo because it's the biggest holding besides Apple for the greatest investor of all time. And I'd pick Amazon, even though I think Amazon probably has a sizable pullback left in it. But over 10 years, I think Amazon is not only the greatest company on this earth, but President Trump has probably looked at every possible way to stop their progress, and he can't do it. They're probably never going to have an enemy like they do with him today. So 10 years from now, Amazon's going to be higher than it is right now. Question number six. This is a two-part question. Do you have any view on the current market downturn, and what deal is most at risk in the event that the market continues to sell off? So to, again, relate this to M&A, I'm of the view that the China trade war is, yes, it's on people's minds, but this sell-off has everything to do with interest rates. Therefore, if we continue to sell off in equities, I would assume that rates were continuing to rise. And while a half a point rise won't kill the deal environment, private equity deals could, I guess, take a step back. In addition, again, as it relates to the podcast, traditional ARB spreads are pretty much a simple ratio to the 10-year treasury. General rule of thumb, and this has been since the 1970s when merger ARB became fairly popular, was simply just to add 400 to 500 basis points to whatever the 10-year was yielding, and that's a proper deal spread. So if rates continue to rise, spreads will continue to widen. So if I had to target one deal situation that would be at risk, no question for me, it would be Arconic, and the ticker on there is ARNC. I have no position. I have not played this from the long side at all. In fact, I've been saying I think this is about 50-50 at best. It's probably the biggest deal, or the biggest prospective deal on the table right now. The media has been reporting that the bid ask is a bit far apart. PE seemingly bidding in the mid-20s, and Arconic is looking for upper 20s. And frankly, the higher rates go, the less of a chance that the two sides will meet. And remember, this stock came from 17 before the talks began. So the one stock I would be worried about is Arconic, ARNC. And lastly, question seven, do you have an opinion on ITG and Virtu Financial getting together? The ticker on this is ITG, and the buyer is VIRT. Now, on October 4th, Bloomberg reported that Virtu was exploring a bid for ITG, and shares spiked from 22 to 27.5. Now, this is not a space I fully understand, to be honest with you. ITG is extremely undercovered. Sandler O'Neill and JP Morgan are the only analysts here, and neither one of them has published a takeout value from what I see. And the only insight I could add, perhaps, is a reminder of timing. So 18 months ago, Virtu bought a company called KCG Holdings for over $1 billion. And the story was broken by the press March 15th, 2017. And the transaction was announced on April 20th. And it closed quickly, only 2 months later. Sandler O'Neill is describing ITG as a unique asset, and they would fit nicely with Virtu. They believe that if ITG were bought for $29 a share, it would be roughly 7% accretive to Virtu. Now, I have no position here, and to be honest, I hadn't really looked into this before the question came in, so thank you. If the market sold off and ITG perhaps went to the low 26s, I think I would get interested, but again, it's not something I fully understand, and I think I would stay small nonetheless. That is it for According to Sources for the week of October 14th, 2018. Couple of closing notes. Remember, I often tweet out my positions and ideas in real time. The handle, again, is at Accord to Sources. A full list of episodes is available at my website. That's accordingtosourcespodcast.com. You can email me directly from there. And finally, if you are liking the content, please feel free to subscribe to this podcast on either iTunes or, you know, however you listen, and leave a review. It will continue to help me to get great guests on the show. Lastly, if you have a suggestion for a guest that you think would be a great fit for the show, please feel free again to reach out and email me. Once again, this has been Mike Samuels, founder and portfolio manager of Broom Street Capital, and I'll see you next week.